Welcome everybody to episode 6 of the new Golden Arrow series, looking back at the BDO World Championship. And I'm delighted today to be joined by an absolute legend of the game, the 1995 World Champion, Richie Bennett. How are you, Richie?
Yeah, all right, just bearing up under the strain, as you see.
How are you coping at the moment? I know you're someone who's spoken quite openly about your struggles with mental health in the past, so how is the current situation treating you?
It's not great, you know, but it's the same for everybody, so I have comfort in that, because I'm not on my own. So, it's hard, because I like to be doing things, and I've been stuck up, you know, really for a couple of months now, and, some days I'm okay, others, you know, not okay, so... But, yeah, I'm dealing with it, so it's fine.
Talking of your darting career, you were part of the winning Europe Cup team when you were only 21, but when did you first start playing darts?
Well, I was young, I was about 15, something like that. I think basically the first time I went into a pub. So as I went into a pub, that's all we was all doing.
And then what was the route from that into, playing for the county and then obviously getting picked for the Welsh team?
Yeah, they all came in tandem, you know, the Super League, went from Super League to county, then county to international, and then from an international to a professional, you know. It was a roller coaster, and it was a hell of an adventure, I have to say.
You were one of the players to, you know, perhaps gain greater spotlight after the split in 1993, and in, 1994 you had a fantastic year. You won the Dutch Open, the Welsh Open, the Danish Open, and then you picked up your first TV title at the British Match Play. What are your memories of that occasion?
Oh, not a lot, to be honest. I got drunk after it. No, it was. I was playing like unbelievable darts at the time, so I was expecting to win. I never looked at it like that. I just wanted to win, without putting pressure on myself. So, yeah, I played really well in that, and then, I had the confidence to go on from there.
Definitely. Soon after that, you picked up the World Masters title. You beat the likes of Dennis Ovens, Andy Jenkins, Andy Fordham and Steve Beaton, and that must have been a huge feather in your cap to win that and go into your first World Championship as the reigning World Master and the number 2 seed.
Yes, obviously, I felt invincible, obviously, because I was on such a high. But it's very different from going up to play just one match in the World Championship. So again, I never put too much pressure on myself. I just went there to win, and it just happened. I suppose once you got past the first round, you relax a bit. But the first round was hard, and once I got past that, I don't think I was in any problems all the way through, to be honest, Sue. In the final, I was under great pressure against Barney, because that's what he does. But I always had it in my head that I was going to win, and I just kept doing what I've been doing throughout the week.
I mean, your first game at the 95 World Championships was significant because it was the first game played by both yourself and also Peter Snakebite Wright at a World Championship. Oh. You've always been, a confident player with bags of ability, but would you have said you were nervous before that game?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And he's a type of guy that doesn't show any nerves at all. And he was a right cocky kid in them days. And, I don't know how to take him, to be honest. But luckily, I had something in the back of my mind, and if in doubt, just throw the dice and forget about everything. And that's what I done. And to be honest, it was a good game. That was my hardest game, actually. It was only one leg against the darts in the old game. And that was when I took out 142. And I won 3-1, because there was only one leg thrown against the darts in that game. It was a tough match, really tough.
You came through that one 3-1. You then beat Russell Stewart in the second round, and then Paul Hogan in the quarterfinals. You say the nerves were going as you got through the tournament. Were you increasing in confidence with every game?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I was. Yeah. To be honest, I always felt that the hardest game in any televised event is the semi-finals. Because once you're there, it's just really hard to get into a final. But the semi-finals is the hardest game. And I've always played really well in the semi-finals for some reason because of those nerves. So you have to have some of it, but not too much. There has to be a balance between the confidence and the nerve. You must have some nerves as well, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
Like any professional sportsman will tell you that the nerves do help you because it shows that you are there to win, like, you know.
I mean, did you find it extra challenging in the semi-finals? You were playing Andy Fordham, who was always an incredibly popular player at the Lakeside.
Yeah, and we were sharing the room at the time, and it was quite funny because every day I'd have my ritual, and every day he'd have his ritual would be popping a bottle of pills open from early in the morning, you know. And I'd be sitting down watching telly, and that'd be it, like, you know. It was quite funny, but I played well. The better man won. He said that, and it was. I think it was probably my best game because I was kind of going on to finish it. I went 4-0 up within no time, and I just won 5-2. I'm not sure what it was. Can't remember now. But that was my hardest game. Because that was when I was a bit most nervous, because semi-final, I always found the semi-final the hardest game of a tournament.
I mean, all the previous players I've spoken to in this series, something I've asked them, how well did you sleep before the world final?
Not very well at all. Because I didn't have a drink, I thought, right, I'm going to make myself pop. But I should have gone up and had a few drinks. And maybe. So I don't think I slept at all. And then you try to reserve energy then, because you know you haven't had a good night's sleep, and you end up using more energy by really thinking about, you know, what's going to happen, and it does drain you. But luckily I had enough energy to get through it all.
I mean, talk me through that final with Barney. Obviously, you know, he was someone who in the 90s and early 2000s had immense success in the BDO, but it was a first world final for both of you. You know, what was it like in the practice room beforehand? And then when you went out there, what were the emotions like?
Well, we were both very nervous. I think you could see that. It was both new to both of us. But we were both ready. We were both playing really well. And, you know, beforehand, you just want to get up there. You know, you just want to you don't want an extra minute. You don't want an extra 5 minutes. You want to get up there and get it on. And that's the nerves kicking in, that is. And I think up until about 5 minutes before the final, I needed the toilet and been sick a couple of times. But as soon as I got on the stage, all that went away, you know, and we were ready to go. We were both playing really well, so that's what we're there for. We knew that.
And when that final double went in, what did that mean to you?
Oh, it was unreal. It's surreal, you know. I just went through the motions. I had no emotion at the time because I was just, you know, it was something that I wanted always. It was a dream of mine to become world champion, and there it was. So, yeah, it doesn't hit you until about a few weeks or months later, you know. You are on a real high. You're just floating across the ground, and it's, it's like having a real good drink there, if you know what I mean.
I was going to say, when did it hit you? When did you sit back and think, wow, you know, I'm the champion of the world?
Oh, a few weeks later, because it just went wild down here in Wales, and everywhere I went, it was just chaotic, and it was a good time. You don't realise until a few weeks later, actually, what you've done. Because you don't really have much time to yourself to reflect, so...
And did it feel extra special? Obviously, you know, you're a proud Welshman, a Welsh international. Did it mean more that you were the second Welshman to win a world title and the first since Leighton Rees won the first one?
Yeah, that's right. And it was a long time, you know, it was a long wait for it. So, it was about time, I felt as well. And, it was an amazing time, absolutely amazing.
And do you remember what you spent the £34,000 prize money on?
Oh, I blew that in no time, Christ. I didn't last long. But it's the other days for me. I'm known for that. Christ, I think about 6 months later, the ducks were chucking bread at me when I was walking past the river. So, you know, money doesn't lie. Money never goes, so I enjoyed it anyway.
So you would say that definitely the trophy meant more than the cheque at the end of it?
Yeah, I see. I'd probably give, I don't know, the trophy was in bits and suddenly I had it back. I don't know what I've done to that. But No, really, I took it with me everywhere, see, and of course, there's exhibitions and, you know, you have a bit of a drink or what have you, and of course, you know, it it ended up falling out of my hands a few times and what have you. So, yes, very memorable.
When you went back in 1996, when I spoke to John Walton a couple of weeks ago, he said that for him, the hardest game at the World Championship was his first round game in 2002, coming in as the defending champion. Would you say that was fair in 96 when you played Wayne Weening?
No. I was really confident. I honestly felt I should have won that year, but no, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. I didn't feel the nerves at all, really. I was really confident there.
I mean, you won the first four games that year, extended your winning run at Lakeside to 9 games.
Yeah.
Going into the final, did you feel any extra pressure that if you'd won, you would have been the first person since Eric Bristow to retain the title?
No, at the time, I didn't think about that at all. Probably the worst I played all week was the second half of the final after the break, because I came out after the break and I wasn't. Something happened in the break, and it's been said to me that I might have been spiked or something like that. But I've never said that in the past, because I would take the gloss away from Steve Beaton. But I definitely wasn't feeling right after the break in the final. And so I was. Anyway, it was a good thing for me, because the loss, you know, put me back down to earth and made me work a little bit harder. And of course, like in life for me, things could go wrong, and something did, and you just live with them and you don't regret anything, you just carry on.
What was your relationship like with Steve Beaton?
Yeah, we had a good relationship. We were good, quite friendly. There was no problems at all. He played better than me in the final, and he deserved to be the world champion that year. He played well all throughout the week, so.
So just to go back, you mentioned that spiking incident. What do you think happened? Was it, you know, a drink during the interval halfway through, or?
Yeah, I don't know. It's possible. I don't know. I have no proof. It's just things have been said to me, you know, about it, and my family were moved from their seats prior to the break for Steve Beaton's family to be moved in because they came there late. Well, that didn't help me as well, and I knew about that. So, yeah, it was a lot of things that happened that, you know. I honestly felt that the BBO didn't want me as world champion, and an Englishman hadn't won it for a while. So, you know, that's. Yeah, I lost to the better man, so. But there were some things there that I felt could have been a factor, but at the end of the day, I had no proof of it, and it's possible if it, you know, but. It's not something I've dwelt on anyway.
I mean, you say you didn't think the BDO wanted you to be world champion. What was your relationship like with Ollie Croft?
We didn't have a relationship. He didn't like me. I didn't like him. I just felt that he was no good for the game, and he felt that I was no good for the game. We talked to each other, but we knew we had massive differences, so we were kept apart a lot, I think. Because I wasn't shy of saying what I felt. So I respected the man, because he did do wonders for the game to start. But the game outgrew him, and he thought he owned it, and that wasn't the case.
Moving on from that, 1997, the World Championships, you suffered a shock exit in the last 16 to Leo Lorenz. How did you respond to a defeat like that, which to most people was a massive shock?
I was shell shocked, to be honest, at the time. Whatever I did, and he done better. I was having a lot of stick off the crowd, mind, but those excuses, I went up there confidently and come off there, lost 3-0, no excuses whatsoever. So, no, I took it on the chin. It was a shock, yeah. He'd been there before, I don't think he'd won a game there, but, you know, things like that happen. I didn't turn up that night for some reason.
When you came back then in 1998, someone I spoke to recently, actually, Marshall James. What was it like to kind of rebound with a win against a fellow Welshman?
That was a tough game, to be honest. And it was tough on me, but I thought, because he lost in the final the previous year, he's going to be under a lot of pressure as well. So I think I played on that, you know. I just loosened my shoulders in that game, and I won, well, quite easily. Marshall is a slow player, so you have plenty of time in between throws to steady yourself. You know, it can be an advantage or a disadvantage. It's never bothered me, to be honest. But I played well, and the pressure was more on him than it was on me, because he'd lost the previous year in the final, whereas I'd lost first round, so...
Your average against Kevin Painter in the next round at the time was your highest ever average on the Lakeside stage. And then, I mean, you beat Peter Johnston fairly comfortably, Roland Charlton very comfortably. And then that final against Barney, you know, is one of the great BDO World Championship finals. You lost 6-5 and you finished with an average of 97.1, which remains the highest ever losing average in a BDO World Championship final. Do you think that year was your best ever performances at the Lakeside?
Yes, I do, yeah. My average for doubles in the final was atrocious. I can't remember what it was. But it was pointed out to me that if I had averaged, say, 33% of doubles, my average would have been about 112. There's a score in, I'm a score in, and was great. But every time I missed a double, he punished me. And fair play to him, I couldn't get rid of him. I honestly thought I could outscore him, and I did many times, but slipped up. And he only needed a sniff at any shot, and he was out. And he always hit that double last night. And in the end, it just broke me. It broke me. It actually broke my heart. Because I honestly thought that nobody could take what I was giving them, and he did. And in all fairness, he became a great world champion afterwards.
In later years, the format was extended to best of 13. Do you think you would have been able to win that game if you had an extra couple of sets, or do you think the doubles would have still let you down?
I wouldn't know it was. Probably, you know, you're always in it, so yes, I would have still believed in, you know, in myself. So, yeah, I would have kept going until the very last start.
And I mean, at that time, you'd also started to play in the odd few PDC events as well. When was it that you made the decision in your mind? I know you moved after, officially moved after you went out in the first round in 1999 against Ronnie Baxter.
Yeah.
But when did you make the decision that, you know, I've had enough of the BDO, the PDC is where I'm going moving forward?
No, I think it went way back to 96. After I lost to Beaton, I was ready to go then. Because I had absolutely no support or credit given to me off the PDO whatsoever. So if anybody was asked to do an exhibition and they phoned the BDO, they would, the last person they would give would be me. And I was the world champion, because a lot of players were doing my work. So it was all, I don't know where it was. Being Welsh didn't help at the time, I got to say. The BDO just, I didn't get on, because I was too controversial. I said things about the PDC, which I thought was good for the sport, but because it was said and they took it that it was against the BDO, so that was up to them.
So why did you finally go in 1999 then?
I was probably happy at the time doing BDO, but I wanted to do the PDC as well. But we weren't allowed to do that, so... You know, it's too early to live in then. You have to win the World Championship to break even for the year, because you would go into tournaments in the BDO and you'd have to win them to break even, you know, sometimes on a loss. So it was the only tournament, so at the end, I just couldn't live like that. I couldn't... In the end, I was doing like a couple of tournaments, enough points to get into the World Championship, but not bothering, because there was no point. Once you're in it, you're in it. I wanted to play more tournaments professionally. The BDO wasn't doing that for me.
I mean, the first few years when you switched over to the PDC, you had some, you know, real... But perhaps not, you know, tournament wins, but certainly, you know, successes in those big televised events. World Match Play semi-final in 2000... World Championship quarterfinals 2002 and 2003, and obviously memorably the World Match Play final in 2001 when you lost to Phil Taylor.
To be honest, I was in and out of alcoholism at the time. I was drinking heavily. I wasn't really focused on that. There was this potluck that sometimes I would go far in the tournament. It was only through experience. So yeah, my lifestyle wasn't great, and yeah, it, you know, in hindsight, would I have done those things again? I've known me, I probably would have. So you know, I have no regrets.
Did you ever seek treatment for that?
Yes and no. You know, doctor, so I'll never see anybody. But you know, I got through it all. I've always been a bit of a lad, but you know, the drink was getting the better. It was part of the course, because when we were doing exhibitions every night, I had a few drinks because I'm pretty shy about it. You know, I have a few drinks and I come out of my shell, and that's what you want to see in exhibitions. So it sort of went with the job, like, I was caught up in it. So, but you know, that's the way it went. And, you know, I don't regret anything, because I probably would do the same again.
And did the drinking and stuff, was that what contributed to kind of, between 2005, 2010, you having a real barren period and actually sort of coming off the tour for a while?
Yeah. Well, I hardly played at all, so it was a rough time. But we got through it, like, and yeah, that's the way it goes. Yeah, it was, most basically, problems and personal problems and drink. That was probably the reason why I wasn't there.
Did you actually struggle with dartitis during that time as well? Because I know...
Yeah, that's another thing. When I drank, I'd always had problems releasing the dart. So, I had that. When I was more or less forced to make a comeback in 2000 and something, I can't remember, 2008, 2009, I still had it, so... But what I did, I locked myself in a room for about 3 weeks. Threw at the dartboard, and if I couldn't let it go, I used to throw myself at the dartboard. I'd be black and blue, honest to God. But I got rid of it. But what came out of that was the snatch. That's how I got that snatch, you know. I put something in my head that if I felt under pressure and the snatch was going to be hard to throw, I was determined to throw it on no matter what, and it clicked in my head, and then when I throw it, I'd snatch it. But it was more of a willingness of mine to let that dart go than an actual snatch, if you know what I mean.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you've spoken before in other interviews about that time that, you know, you ended up signing on to the Dole and you became a roofer and so on. Was that when, for you, you really acknowledged that the depression that you struggled with, or did that start long before?
It didn't help. I mean, it was a downtime, and you don't realise you've had depression until years later. Then you have these thoughts, and you think, Christ, why was I thinking like that at the time? Why wasn't I happy? You know. Some people have got anxiety problems and don't really know it. So yeah, I know a lot about it now, because I've seen people and you know, seeked help and got help, and I know exactly what to do when I feel like I've got it coming on again.
I mean, when you came back, you know, 2011, when you really started playing again, I mean, you had a tremendous run from there to sort of 2014.
Yeah.
And I mean, in 2011, you got to the semis of the World Grand Prix after you beat Gary Anderson, you know, Dennis Ovens, and you then obviously lost to Phil in the semis. But what was the emotion relief like to know that you'd reached a TV major semi-final for the first time in a decade?
To be honest, I was really ready to kick on from that, because I was starting to get confidence back, and then of course I got caught taking drugs, and then that's another issue. But no, I would have been definitely a top eight player if I hadn't been caught doing drugs. My own stupid fault, but you know, do I regret it? Oh, yeah, don't I? If there's one regret I got, that's it. But yeah, I honestly felt I was really making. And my scoring was back to what it should be, and I just missed a couple of doubles here and there. But I always give myself chances against every player I played. And I knew if I could string a few victories together after that, I'd be a force again. But it didn't happen to me.
Before we get to 2014 and obviously what happened there, I mean, you did have real success. You know, 2012, you hit the nine darter in one of the UK Open qualifiers. 2012 and 2013, you got to the World Cup semis with Mark Webster. And in 2014, you know, you got to a Pro Tour final. You beat Michael Van Gerwen on the way, and, you know, you had chances to beat Gary Anderson in the final. So you did have real success at that time. And I remember, you know, reading and listening to stuff you were saying at the time that consistency you felt was a massive problem. Did that stem from the snatching of your throw?
No, I, to be honest, it was the consistency thing in that as it is now. It's not always to do with you, it's to do with the other players, because everybody is playing so well. It is like a melting pot now. It's so many people on that level. And you can make one mistake in the whole level leg match and lose by that one leg, but it's only one mistake you've made, and that's how difficult it is. So to have consistency now, you've got to be one really, really phenomenal player. And like I say, those players are the ones who are in the top 8 in the world, so they deserve to be, because it's very, very hard.
And one incident during that period, you obviously got into a bit of a scrap on stage with Adrian Lewis. What was your take on that?
Well, it's as simple as this. I remember my snatch, my leg was going back, and I was kicking him in the shins. And he shouldn't be there. And I constantly told him about being there. And nothing happened. You know, I had my head off because, you know, nobody would do anything about it. So in the end, I told him, you know, for fuck's sake, like, you know, you shouldn't be there. If he's moaning with me kicking him in the shin, you shouldn't be there. You know what I mean? And there's exclusions all there. And the proof is in the pudding, because he got fined, I didn't. You know, so, now, you know, I like Adrian, but like I say, at the end of the day, if he won three grand more than I did, so he's not going to give a damn about me. I wasn't going to give a damn about him, because once people start bullying on the hockey, they'll continue to do so, and it won't happen with me. So that's how that went. So, but I've got on in great terms since. He knew what he was doing, and I knew what he was doing. So it's the line had been drawn under it, and that's it. It's all done.
Moving on to the drugs ban now, which is obviously a sensitive topic, I know. But you know, when you walked into the room and you saw the tester there, did you know that you were in trouble?
Yes. Yeah, I honestly felt it was a sting. I still don't believe to this day that it's random. No way. But if I didn't do it, I wouldn't have got caught, play, and I've accepted it. I did it on a Friday. This was a Monday. Still in my system, so it's my own stupid fault. And yeah, it drove me. That was my worst. For the next 2 years, it was the worst time of my life. Constantly thinking about suicide. Constantly. Just lying on the kitchen floor at 3, 4 in the morning, drunk, and just lying there with my arms out and my legs out like a star, and just look up into the sky, and it's stupid. Yeah, it's just, you know, I thought my luck was up, but, you know, I'm still, yeah.
I mean, was that the first time that you'd done it in around near a competition, or was it just that time you got caught?
Yeah, it's the first time I've done it near a competition, definitely. It wasn't the first time I'd done it. It was the last, that's for sure. But no, I'd done it before, but never taken cocaine before or during or even after a match. Because it's the worst drink for you, the flow dash, because you shake like hell. So, you know, what I don't get, it's classed as cheating, and Christ, I took this on a Saturday, and I'm playing on a Monday, so, you know. And well, that's the rules, and, you know, I was the one who they picked to, I felt, tell the top boys, if you get caught, this is what's going to happen to you. There was no leeway from day one to my trial. There wasn't any leeway whatsoever. I was going to get the maximum, and that was it. So, it is what it is, and like I say, if I didn't know it, I wouldn't have been called. So I can't say any blame or give any blame to anybody but myself.
And did you, I know you appealed the ban, but did you think the ban that they gave to you was fair?
No, totally unfair. I mean, I suffered depression, I give them all that. Give everything I could as to why. Didn't do it on the day, didn't do it the day before even. Or the day before that, the day before that I did, sorry. God, it just wanted me. I honestly felt that it was there to be made an example of, and it's my own stupid fault, and it was done, and that's it. It really, really finished me, didn't it, really? So, they reduced it by 6 months, but really speaking, they had to reduce it by a year, to a year, because I had a 28-man ban by the time I come back, I could play again, because I had to go to Q school then the following year. You know, so 28 months I was banned for, really. And that hurt as well, because they were giving away with one hand and taking away with the other hand. And reduced to 18 months was just, that meant absolutely nothing. So that's what I was getting about. They admitted that the 2 years was too much, but then, I thought they could only give a year. No, but they reduced it by 6 months, so it was still the same then.
And do you think, I know in the proceedings you cited the example of Jake Livermore who played for West Brom, and obviously he admitted to taking it after, he lost a child and so on.
Yeah, well, I'd lost a child as well the previous 6 months. My girlfriend lost a child. I gave all that. 34 points of depression I give, and it's still had 2 years he got off with it. So you're trying to tell me that wasn't an example to be made of. There's a lot to be said, really, that hasn't been said. But at the end of the day, whatever happens, it's going to come back on me and it's going to be said, well, if you didn't take it, you wouldn't have had this problem. So, I just got to accept that. And I have. I've accepted it.
And do you feel, now, I think, even, it's only, say, just over 5 years ago, but I feel personally now as a society, we're a lot more open about, mental health and people struggling. Do you think if it had happened, say, late 2019, say 5 years later, do you think you would have been treated any differently?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know how they do it behind the scenes. But mental health has become more in the limelight. So I don't know. I'm not qualified really to answer that. But our past experience when I was dealt with, there was absolutely no. There's no hearing of me. They wasn't listening. So that was that.
And just a couple last questions on that one. You say that you feel they were trying to make an example of you. Did you believe that there were other players on or around the tour at that time who were doing similar things?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There is no, you haven't got to be Sherlock to work that out. And the world knows, but it's just. I the one who got caught for him. Eric said to me, unfortunate me for you, you're a big enough name and you're dispensable. And that's what Eric said to me. And a lot of people have said that as well, mind. They've felt it, so that was said. You're a big enough name to get in the papers and you're dispensable. So, my time had gone as far as, people were concerned. But, I still got something left, I might have one last hurrah, you never know.
I mean, just one last point on that. What was the reaction like from, fellow players and, manufacturers and teams? Did they, reach out to you during that time, or did you feel you were kind of left out in the cold a bit?
Oh, if you left out in the cold, you wouldn't believe. Never heard from any players. Not one. Probably only Barry Bates. Just me and Barry's friends, but other players, not one. They don't give a damn. And there's a lesson to be learned there, boys. If you do get caught, boys, you won't have any sympathy of anybody. Trust me, not anything at all.
And, you know, when you, you know, eventually were able to come back, you went on the challenge tour, you won two events from 11 starts. You mentioned that, you know, you really did struggle with, you know, depression and suicidal thoughts. How did you get from then to having the determination to come back and you know, producing really good darts when you did come back?
Well, it only lasted for about, say, 5 months or similar, because I eventually got... As soon as I got back on the Pro Tour then, I had a floating bone in my knee and I couldn't put weight on my front leg, so that kept me bad for about 3 months. Then I had tennis elbow, and I just had a catalogue of things. Then I had depression again through it, and you know, what have you. So, really, since then, I've had nothing but problems with look, it's his age now. I'm 53 now, and I don't know, it's just I just have to start having a clean living, I think. Yeah, I just had bad luck ever since. Really has, still, just little things, you know, like tennis elbow. I couldn't do nothing with that, so lucky Burnett strikes again, I suppose.
And I mean, at the start of this year, you know, you went to Q School again and, you know, biggest field ever. You then were Challenge Tour first weekend, in fact, the only weekend, you know, we've had this year, and you picked up, you know, £350. So not necessarily, you know, top of the rankings, but still some decent runs over the course of the days. How would you assess your performances there?
Well, yeah, you see, at the moment, I forgot about my eye. I had an operation on my eye, but that's done. But my eye got off my other one done now. I can have cataracts on any other one, so I've got to use a contact lens in there. But no, I actually, since the lockdown, I've hardly thrown it out, but I have thrown here and there, and I'm playing fine. It's just waiting now, isn't it, for it to get back in. I'm looking forward to it, you know, I really am. It's like being banned again without being banned, you know. So, yeah, it is. I was kind of looking forward to getting back now. So, see how things go.
So, have you not been playing any of these, you know, darts from home lockdown competitions?
No. I, to be honest, I don't know nothing about them. I'm being asked or nothing. So, you know, if I'm not asked, I won't bother. So, no, I don't know nothing about them. Until he came on and somebody said to me about him, I said, oh, I don't know. You know, that's what it is.
You know, what would it mean to you to be able to get a tour card back and actually go on the Pro Tour and not necessarily, you know, get to maybe, you know, obviously the dream would be getting back to winning, you know, major events and world titles, but just to be able to get back on the Pro Tour and, you know, be a tour card holder and be winning and mixing with the best again?
Yeah, you see, it's not be an end all for me, but... I probably will do it, you know. There's nothing slowing me. I'm in good health. Once I've had my eye done now, I'll have, you know, everything be working normally. I hope everything. see if it goes from there. Because, I'm playing all right. If I hit doubles, I can beat anybody. Absolutely. There's no problem at all. It's just hitting doubles. I mean, if you make one mistake, you know, you just don't do that. But if I'm having darts or double in every leg, I should be winning 11-0, you know? But instead I'm losing the 6-5 all the time, so I must be making much more than one mistake, but there are.
I mean, obviously, you know, we started this by talking about, you know, 1988, you winning the Europe Cup as part of the Welsh team. You know, you have been playing darts, you know, a long time, but when do you anticipate that, you know, Richie, the Prince of Wales, Burnett will keep going till?
Until he can't throw no more. Simple as that. Still love the game, you know. Still love it. I still love travelling. I still love like going out on my own when I'm away. I love the danger of being on my own and stuff like that, you know. I like seeing life and being there, you know. So I won't stop until I can't do it.
And you know, a couple of things. You always seemed like a real character. When you were playing, did you have to kind of amp up your personality when you were going on stage, or was that just the pure natural Richie Burnett?
It was just let it all go, because you know, by being reserved, I wasn't winning, I wasn't playing well, so let's let it go this leg, you know, let's get it go, you know, and then you know, get yourself going, and It's just the way I am.
And do you kind of feel the modern games maybe lacking some of the characters that were around when you first started playing?
Express themselves like you used to, because the DRE would just jump on you. But you've got to watch what you say, you've got to watch what you do. That's why I feel I don't get it through at all, because especially live, I don't know what I'm going to say. So the chances are they're on pins, So there ain't many, there was a lot. They're more professional in their days. And I obviously think that most of them are narcissists. That's all they think about is themselves. But I suppose you've got to be like that to get anywhere. But it certainly doesn't endear you to the public, does it?
Well, I guess also, with the amount of money that's available now, you think how much you get now for winning the World Championship. Obviously, there's so much more on the line. Than perhaps there was in I'm not saying wasn't as much on the line in decades gone by, but now an awful lot of these guys will be full-time pros.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say 64. Well, I'd say about 75% of the top 128 in the world at the moment are professionals. So there's a lot of narcissism in there, I can assure you.
And one last thing from me. I mean, you might have seen it on Netflix recently. There's been the series The Last Dance about Michael Jordan, and all about his legacy and what kind of made him the sportsman that he was. And I saw online people were saying, if there was another sport and another person, who would you like to see the documentary made about? And a couple of people suggested to me that they'd love to see a documentary about the life and career of Richie Burnett. What would that look like for you, that series?
Oh my god, yeah, that would take some filming out, I can show you. Oh yeah, there's so many people, honestly, you wouldn't believe every day of my life. Say, why didn't you write the book? And I've just never done it. I can't, just. Yeah, you never know. One day I might make one last dance. Who knows?
And I just want to say thank you so much for your time, your frankness, your honesty. You are a legend of the game, and it's been fascinating to hear your ups, your downs, and just the lengthy career you've had. So thank you very much for your time, Richie.
Andrew, thank you very much for your time as well. You're a gentleman. Thank you. I appreciate it.